Right, we are moving into 2 Samuel, because you would have it so. After the death of Saul, when David had returned from striking down the Amalekites, David remained 2 days in Ziklag. And on the third day, behold, a man came from Saul's camp with his clothes torn and dirt on his head. And when he came to David, he fell to the ground and paid homage. David said to him, "Where do you come from?" And he said, "I have escaped from the camp of Israel." And David said to him, "How did it go? Tell me." And he answered, "The people fled from the battle, and also many of the people have fallen and are dead. And Saul and his son Jonathan are also dead." Then David said to the young man who told him, "How do you know that Saul and his son Jonathan are dead?" And the young man who told him said, "By chance I happened to be on Mount Gilboa, and there was Saul leaning on his spear, and behold, the chariots and the horsemen were close upon him. And when he looked behind him, he saw me and called to me, and I answered, 'Here I am.' And he said to me, 'Who are you now?' And I answered him, 'I am an Amalekite.' And he said to me, 'Stand beside me and kill me, for anguish has seized me, and yet my life still lingers.' So I stood beside him and killed him, because I was sure that he could not live after he had fallen. And I took the crown that was on his head and the armlet that was on his arm, and I have brought them here to my lord." Then David took hold of his clothes and tore them, and so did all the men who were with him. And they mourned and wept and fasted until evening for Saul and for Jonathan his son and for the people of the Lord and for the house of Israel, because they had fallen by the sword. And David said to the young men who told him, "Where do you come from?" And he answered, "I am the son of a sojourner, an Amalekite." David said to him, "How is it that you were not afraid to put out your hand to destroy the Lord's anointed?" Then David called one of the young men and said, "Go execute him." And he struck him down so that he died. And David said to him, "Your blood be on your hand, head, for your own mouth has testified against you, saying, 'I have killed the Lord's anointed.'" Now David lamented with this lamentation over Saul and Jonathan his son, and he said it should be taught to the people of Judah. Behold, is it written in the book of Yashar. He said, "Your glory, O Israel, is slain on your high places. How the mighty have fallen. Tell it not in Gath. Publish it not in the streets of Ashkelon. Lest the daughters of the Philistines rejoice. Let the daughters of the uncircumcised exult. You mountains of Gilboa, let there be no dew or rain upon you, nor fields of offerings. For there the shield of the mighty is defiled, the shield of Saul, not anointed with oil. From the blood of the slain, from the fat of the mighty, the bow of Jonathan turned not back, and the sword of Saul remained not empty. Saul and Jonathan, beloved and lovely, in life and in death they were not divided. They were swifter than eagles. They were stronger than lions. You daughters of Israel, weep over Saul. Who clothed you in luxury, in scarlet, who put ornaments of gold on your apparel. How the mighty have fallen in the midst of battle. Jonathan lies slain on your high places. I am distressed for you, my brother Jonathan. Very pleasant you have been to me. Your love to me was extraordinary, surpassing the love of a woman. How the mighty have fallen, and the weapons of war have perished." This translation doesn't use the term the song of the bow that other translations do. It's a textual variant, and so each translation makes a decision whether to put that in or not. But it seems that David called this particular lament, this psalm, the song of the bow because of Jonathan's chosen weapon. You remember back in 1 Samuel with Jonathan shooting his arrows and such. So that's what David is talking about here. When I'm not working, spending time with my wife and such, there's a couple of things that we like to do, both of which you probably hear way more than you want to about. But one is, of course, getting out on our bikes, and the other is going to hear live music. And I was reflecting on both of those things this week and even yesterday as we did both of those things, and looking at this particular passage. Let me tell you why. Because one of the things where I think God's grace is evident to me, I see it in so many ways. It's one of the things that I have some hope that I'm finally showing some kind of maturity as a Christian, that I'm starting to see the hand of God's grace more really, more and more clearly in more places. But one of those is that if I only saw particularly young men by being out to hear live music, I would be very despairing of the state of manhood in our country. I sort of am anyway, but it's just, it's sad, some of the things you say, and I see, and I could go on, but let's just leave it at that, and you can use your own imaginations, and some of you have probably seen it, and can know what the kind of things that I'm talking about. On the other hand, this is where God's grace comes in. We get out on the bike trails, and it seems more and more and more we're seeing families out together. You know, father, mother, kids out on their bikes, you know, and I just delight in seeing that. Families together and doing something together and out on the bike trail together, and it gives me hope. for manhood in our culture. And I see that they're not all like these guys over here, but there are these guys out here that are seeking to raise their families and be with them and spend time with them and so on. So it gives me great encouragement and delight. Sometimes I wish they'd be more coaching and teaching left and right to their children more than they do. But still, it's a joy to see them out there. You know, and my impatience at trying to get around them sometimes is greatly tempered by just knowing that they're there and that they're together doing that. Those things were particularly striking to me this week because when I looked at this passage, I thought, well, you know, what we're seeing as we're working through first and now into 2 Samuel is David becoming the king. So David is not merely becoming the king, but David is really becoming the man of God. You know, we think of David as the man after God's own heart. And sometimes we focus on the latter part of that, man after God's own heart. And we're going to talk about that. I think we've mentioned it at least a little bit. I think we tend to misunderstand that. And I'll just give you that little premise or promise that we will talk about it and how we can misunderstand that. But what we often miss because we race to what does it mean to be after God's own heart, so we miss that David was a man after God's own heart. He was a man after God's own heart. And what we're seeing is David not only becoming a king, but becoming a man and becoming a man of God. And that just is what stood out most clearly to me in this. So in the notes, if you looked at them, I said leaders, because these aren't characteristics that should only be true of men. They should be true of all Christian people, certainly. But they should particularly be true of men, and the kind of men that we want to see as leaders in our families, in our church family, in our country. And so I want to focus on three particular things that we see in David. There are more here, but these three are give us enough for Father's Day. A brief look. First of all, okay, we have the story. We need to talk a little bit about the story. Because those of you who were here last week, and if not, if you happen to look back at the last chapter of 1 Samuel, you see a very different story than what you get in the beginning of 2 Samuel. Now, some see this as a great contradiction. This is one of those places where which story is it? And perhaps the writer, whoever he was, is using different source material. You know, and he used some source material to talk about, you know, Saul falling on his own sword. And now we change to the source material that has this Amalekite coming along and killing him there on the battlefield. And you know, we don't really, in the confusion of the day, who knows? And so there were different accounts. I think that's nonsense, and it's not at all difficult to see what's going on here. And I think that the Spirit, as he gives us this, just assumes that we'll understand what's going on, and we're given a clue by that. If you look at the very beginning of the chapter, David was out fighting again with the Amalekites, right? David fighting the Amalekites. And then he gets back to Ziklag, and who shows up? An Amalekite. Who have we been taught sort of throughout this are the enemies of God's people? Those who stand in opposition to God and the things of God are the Amalekites. And so who shows up again at Ziklag? An Amalekite. And he tells a story very different than the story that we saw at the end of 1 Samuel. And what conclusion are we to draw is he is lying. And why would he lie about such a thing? Because he sees a chance to be in with David. Apparently he knows what many knew. It was no secret at all. Jonathan said it. Saul said it. You are going to be king. Everyone knew that David was next in line. Jonathan, in an act of covenant love for David, had really ceded his place, his rightful place of taking over for his father should he die, should anything happen to him. And Jonathan said, no, 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 David will be the king. So everyone knew it. This man knew it. So apparently he was there at the battle, found Saul fallen or saw Saul fall or whatever, and managed to swoop in and get some goodies, the crown and his royal amulet. He said, I'll take these to David, and he will rejoice at the death of his enemy, and I'll be in with the new king. I'll be the one that brought him the symbols of kingship and brought him the good news that Saul, his enemy, is dead. And so he goes to David, and he lies. And David believes his lies. And it doesn't turn out well for the Amalekite, because David believed him. David hears the message and doesn't rejoice. Probably some of his men were confused, too. So Saul's dead? The path is open for you now to be king. This is good news. And yet David mourns and grieves. Sometimes he tears his clothes, which is a sign of grief, the ritual sign of grief, and then wails. We know David was a man of deep emotion. And we know that David was a man not at all afraid of showing that deep emotion. And so he mourns passionately, and he gets the men to mourn with him. And it's not hard to imagine them beginning to enter into that, is it? Have you ever been around people that are really sorry, who are mourning something, who are in a time of grief? It's not really very long before you think, I'm going to try to encourage them, and the next thing you feel the dampness falling down your own cheeks. And you've really entered into their grief. And that can be an encouragement to them. It is. So when David is mourning for Saul and for Jonathan and for Israel, and for the honor and integrity of God that he recognizes has been disgraced, the house of Israel has fallen, there is a sign that the Philistines are going to be mocking God, praising their false gods for their defeat of the God of Israel. So David sees great cause for grief and takes action, leads his men in signs of grief, of sorrow, of mourning. And then he takes action with this Amalekite. He says, how is it you weren't afraid to strike down the Lord's anointed? That's a capital crime. And he executes that. And it might look vicious, but it was the crime, the punishment. David had, remember, twice had opportunity to kill Saul and said, I won't do it, and held back his men from doing it, restrained them, probably physically, saying, no, no, we will not kill Saul. We will not raise our hand against the Lord's anointed. And now this man comes and is proud of having done it and expecting David to celebrate what he has done. And David grieves at what he has done and says, no, you must die for that. But it's not about David, right? It's first about God. And then it's even about the people that David's becoming king over. You don't want a man who isn't afraid of striking down the Lord's anointed in your midst. You don't want that kind of attitude. You don't want that kind of character. You don't want that kind of person. So David acts in ways that really lead, defend, protect others around him. It's not about him. It's about God and serving others. So we see that David acts, but he acts in ways that serve God and others. As David grieves, he realizes everyone needs to remember this, and everyone needs to grieve, and so he writes a song about it. This particular psalm that he writes is called a lament. So it's a particular kind of psalm where one expresses grief. Right? Different cultures, different ways of expressing grief. For David, who was a great warrior, and yet also a poet, a songwriter, a singer-songwriter, you know, we don't see those kind of things come together very often anymore. You know, those of a certain age of us, right, remember Barry Sadler, you know, the Green Beret that sang a song, and it was so unusual to have someone who was in the military than having a hit record. You know, it was striking because it was so unusual to us, but it shouldn't be that unusual. These kind of things can come together. And just because we can't imagine, say, John Mayer, you know, being also a mighty warrior, doesn't mean that such things doesn't exist. And David had that soul of a poet, and yet it could be a fierce fighter, a fierce enemy. But here he brings to bear that soul of a poet and sets into words the grief that he feels. And then he thinks that all Israel should feel. He says to them, teach this lament, the song of the bow, to the people of Judah. It's sort of like the people of Texas, you know, used to have, maybe still do, I haven't been in Texas, but you know, remember the Alamo. You know, if you grew up again seeing those movies and such, you remember the Alamo. That's kind of what David is saying here. Remember Saul. Remember Jonathan. Remember Mount Gilboa. Remember this defeat so that it can strengthen us against our enemies. And we don't just remember and lament the defeat, but we remember it so that we can move forward for God. So David puts his grief into words. Grieves over Mount Gilboa, grieves over fallen Saul, says all good things about him. Remember, I should have looked up, I don't remember now, but there were two famous actresses that didn't get along at all. Remember when word came the one that the other had died, she said, well, one should never speak badly of the dead. One should only say good. She says, so-and-so is dead. Good. You would think that David might have such a reaction about Saul, and yet what he remembers are the good things about Saul. So there was a reason this man was anointed king. There were those for whom he was very good. He calls them to join into this lament. Those of you who are clothed in fine clothing, it was because of Saul. Those of you who are at home at ease, it was because of Saul. Remember him and lament. So he looks at the good things. Saul was a good warrior. He was in many ways a good king. As we talked about last week, he was striving to be a good man and just kind of didn't get there in so many ways. He's trying, and David remembers those good things and commends them. And then he particularly grieves over Jonathan, his friend, his covenant friend. So words matter. Words can direct and help our grief. Words can express these things. But I think the key thing to see is that David grieves and calls people to grieve with him. There's a place for grief within the faith. There's a place for deep grief within the faith. Sometimes, as Christians, you know, we can think, oh, no, we have to be happy, happy, happy all the time. You know, you get that stupid brand of Christianity. Sorry. We'll have to run the tape, and I'll put some other adjective in. We don't do that, but we should. But I think it is a stupid form of Christianity. You see, that's, you know, happy, happy, happy. You know, read the Gospels. Read the Bible. People suffered. They understood suffering. And Christians of all people should understand that this world is just not right. Right? It is broken. And stuff hurts. And when we lose things, we grieve. And when we lose people, we grieve. And we ought to grieve. David grieves at the loss of the respect of God. He grieves at the loss of the tribes of Israel. He grieves at the loss of the king and his son, and gathers others into his grief to say, no, this is good. This is good to express this sorrow. Sorrow before God, to know this is not right. We want to do what we can to make it right. But we will never do what we can to make it right if we don't acknowledge that it's wrong. We as a culture tend to shove these things aside, put them out of mind, when we, particularly as a people of God, should be leading the way and saying, no, we want to look right square at the brokenness and grieve for it and hurt over it, because then we know our God is real, our love is real, and we find the strength to say, how can we make it better? David leads the people in grief. And thirdly, leaders love. We see love throughout this chapter in his reaction to the death of Saul, and his reaction to the death of Jonathan, and his talking about Jonathan. Many people have written all kinds of nonsense about David saying, Jonathan, your love was greater than a woman. You know, talk to some soldiers. Right? We have warriors in our congregation. Talk to them about the band of brothers thing. You know, how close are you to men when you're on the battlefield together? How close are you to men when you're in dangerous places together? You know, what is that like? Have you ever developed anything that you could call love? And they might be hesitant to call it love. I hope not. Because the men of God loved people. And you see it in deep emotion. That's the other reason why, besides the parent-grandparents thing that I wanted to read from Timothy, because Paul says to Timothy, he said, I remember your tears, and I long to see you. You see, Paul loves Timothy, and Timothy loves Paul, and they're not afraid to express that love. And they're not even allowed ashamed to show it when it appears as tears at their parting. Sometimes probably at tears that they're coming together. They're not afraid of their emotions. God has created us emotional human beings, and we can't fear those things. And David certainly doesn't fear those things. Jesus certainly didn't fear those things when he wept over Jerusalem, when he grieved over the sins of people, when he laughed with his disciples. You see, a man of full emotion. But again, it's not all about himself. Grieves for Jonathan and for Israel. Grieves before God because he loved God and he loved Saul and he loved Jonathan and he loves the people of God and he loves the men that are around him. And even showing that love in this way is showing real love, because love is first and foremost not about us. Right? Love is about giving. I'm sure I've told you many times, but here's one more time, because one of my favorite things about I've heard about love, quotes about love, was from John MacArthur. He was talking about so much of modern love. When a guy says to a girl, I love you, he said what he means is, I love me and I want you. And I think that's far too true. And for Christians, it should never be that. I love me and I want you. But it should be, I love you. I care about you. I want to serve you. And that kind of loving service is what I believe we see as an outstanding characteristic of the man who will be king in this chapter. And we see it because this is the man who will be king, who will be the type, the image, the forerunner, the forebearer of the King of Kings, who preeminently shows us such love. Let's pray. Well, Father, we thank you for your word. Lord, it is frequently challenging. As we live in a world that is so corrupted and distorted, love, and we live with our souls that are so corrupted and distorted, Lord, help us to see your truth. Help us to know your love, that we might truly be more loving in real, honest, open, transparent, helpful ways. Lord, may the glory go to Jesus, who has loved us. We pray in his name. Amen.